CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Ameri, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Today, we would like to welcome Dr. Elsa Cook to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Cook is an assistant professor in UBC's Department of Chemistry, so thank you so much for joining us today. And, you know, just to start off, because you just mentioned that you have recently joined this UBC this year after completing your PhD and your postdoc. So, you know, just tell us a bit about your journey into this field that you're working in right now. What motivated you to pursue chemistry in the first place? And specifically, how did you decide to concentrate in the field of interstellar chemistry?
Sure. Yeah, I think this is a bit of a weird one for most people. And I get asked this very frequently, how I ended up in this area. And so first of all, just thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate
Definitely.
It.
And thank really you for nice joining us.
Yeah, to share this new area with UBC students. So it's my pleasure to be here. So I started off as a chemistry student. I'm still very much a chemist. So a lot of times I get asked, you know, questions coming from the astronomy side of things, which I really have to kind of reach to the extent of my knowledge to understand. So I trained as a chemist. I did a bachelor's degree in chemistry. And I did that in New Zealand. So I grew up in New Zealand, and you maybe can catch a little bit of the accent. I've been out of New Zealand for 10 years now, so it's fading, but still a little bit there. So I started off straight out of high school. I went to do my bachelor's degree. In New Zealand, a bachelor's degree in chemistry is 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I stayed on. I was really interested in doing research, and I did a few kind of summer projects doing research. And that's when I found, I really liked it. I liked the kind of, you know, it wasn't going and following a lab manual. It was really going to learn something new and discover something for the very first time. And I thought that was just so exciting. So I knew I wanted to do research, first of all. And while I was doing my chemistry degree, I was also doing a lot of physics. I really liked physics as well. And I didn't really know how those two things overlapped. I didn't know what was the area of research that would be the area that I would like to pursue. So I looked a little bit around, and I did lots of different projects, actually. So I had, you know, summer internships studying things like, I studied sheep poo for a while, which was an interesting one, very far away from astrochemistry. I studied honey, so looking at pollen and honey. Lots and lots of different things before I kind of converged on astrochemistry. As a research student in my fourth year, we were doing a kind of thesis, a short thesis project. I don't know if it's similar in Canada, but I had the opportunity to do this thesis project, and I did it in the area of cosmochemistry, which is very similar to astrochemistry, but there are some, you know, kind of slight differences in these two fields. So cosmochemistry looks a bit more at meteorites and rocks. It kind of comes at interstellar chemistry from a geology side of things, a geochemistry side, whereas astrochemistry comes more from the astronomy side, from looking at light coming from space rather than collecting samples. So I got this, you know, first experience in geochemistry and looking at meteorites, and that's how I kind of figured out that it was the area that I wanted to work in. And that was the starting point. So yeah, that's how I got into it. And then I decided I wanted to do a PhD because I really liked research, and that seemed a good enough reason for me. So I looked for places that did astrochemistry in particular, because I thought coming from cosmochemistry, astrochemistry was closer to what I wanted to be doing. And I just applied all over the place, looked for places that had astrochemistry research programs or professors that could offer that research area. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's how I found the PhD position that I ended up in. And then it just kind of, everything led to when the next thing sort of, I ended up in the postdoc position following the PhD, because I was still interested in astrochemistry and I look for postdocs in the field, but I, you know, veered off a little bit from what I did in my PhD, but essentially the path has stayed the same, and I've been interested in this area now for some time.
Interesting.
Yeah. It seems like you've been all over the world, from like France, America, Canada, New Zealand. What was that been like?
Yeah. I know. I almost did a complete circle, right? I just have to end up back in New Zealand. But yeah. I've been really fortunate to be able to go to lots of different places. So, you know, I grew up at the bottom of the world, and I never left New Zealand until I was probably in my early 20s. So I didn't know much about what was happening outside of the bottom of the world. And Yeah, it was really education and research that allowed me to do those things and allowed me to live in these places that I never would have lived otherwise. So that was an amazing, amazing experience.
Yeah. When I think of like chemistry in space, the first thing I think about is like the formation of elements in the stars. That's pretty much as far as we go into in chemistry. Is that pretty much all astrochemistry like derives from?
Okay, so that would be the starting point, I guess. So we definitely, as astrochemists, veer away from that area. So we're not, at least most astrochemists that I know, are not particularly interested in at least the first formation of the elements. So as astrochemists, I guess, as you get the sense from the word chemistry, we're more interested in molecules, so bonds, right? So looking at bond formation. So astrochemists really study molecules in space rather than elements, and that's another... You know, if people are starting to learn about astrochemistry, they might not understand quite what the field entails, but we really look at molecules. Mm-hmm. So things that at least have two atoms or more. And as the field has evolved over the last 50 years, we're now getting molecules that have more and more atoms. So starting with very small, so diatomics and two atom species up until these very, very large species that can contain like 60 atoms. We now have, I think, I keep trying to keep count, but there is so many good researchers in the world that it's really hard to keep track. But we have something like 250 molecules that have been detected in interstellar space. So it's actually a lot. We have lots of different types of molecules that have been found to date. So, yeah, it's an exciting area to work in.
And my astronomy is pretty weak. Do these like atoms and compounds, do they come from like supernovas only, or like where else do they originate from?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so I guess the starting point of getting the atoms that form the molecules is certainly from stars, from supernova, things like that. But in terms of forming the molecules, they tend to form a little bit later in the star formation cycle. So basically what we have is we have this kind of, if you can picture a circle, right? So we start off with these supernova explosions. They spew out atoms. They spew out the kind of material that we use to make molecules. And then that material comes together and they form these big clouds. So these clouds contain then those atoms. And those are what you would picture when you look at these beautiful images of nebula. So you'll see these big glowing regions of the sky that Hubble, if you look at Hubble images, for example. So that would be the next stage of star formation. And then those tend to get kind of denser and denser, they collapse and you tend to bring together these atoms. The atoms then can come together and collide and you would form the very first molecules. So usually quite simple molecules at that stage, but the pressures and the temperatures, they change a lot during star formation and that dictates what kind of molecules you can form. So we go through this sequence of then forming these really dense regions of space, which are very cold and they have a very distinct type of molecules that they form. And then once they get denser and denser, they form what we call a protostar. So the protostar would then be the stage of forming the next star from this material. So it's a cyclic process, right? And so we form this protostar. The protostar is a little bit warmer. And as you know, chemical reactions, they depend a lot on temperature. So the temperatures change. We can have different types of reactions that can occur. And then we can form different molecules. And then that star eventually starts to form, and then we can form new stars. We form new planetary systems, new planets that contain that original kind of chemical soup that we made all the way out in interstellar space. And that's the part that I find really cool, is we're kind of tracing, you know, where these molecules came from that form new planets.
Yeah. I would assume the practicality of studying this sort of thing is very hard in our lowly Earth, where we have a very limited range of pressures and temperatures compared to space. So how does that work?
Yeah. So there's a few different approaches. So in astrochemistry, we typically think of a triangle when we think of the types of approaches that you can have. So one kind of corner of this triangle is lab experiments. So going into the laboratory and trying to make conditions that can simulate space. Then we've got another, which would be computational simulation. So it kind of linked to the lab experiments, but doing things on a computer. And then we can use telescopes. So that would be the third aspect of doing astrochemical research. So a telescope, in a sense that you would look into those reaches of space and try to observe the molecules. I've kind of spread out and work in all of those areas, but I really primarily work on laboratory experiments. So these experiments where you try and simulate some of the conditions in space. So you might try, for example, to make the temperature very cold to simulate these very, very cold temperatures we find in space, and then do reactions at that temperature, figure out if reactions can happen. So in a sense, it's, yeah, trying to simulate these regions of space, but you can only go so far. Like you mentioned, it's very difficult. We can't make interstellar space in the lab as much as we would like to. But in some sense, we also are glad that we can't make it, because many of these chemical processes, they take millions of years to happen in the conditions of space. So we speed them up a little bit in the lab, but we like to, yeah, simulate the things that we would like to observe in space. So yeah, all three areas, they kind of go hand in hand. We need people doing the experiments, we need people using the telescopes, and we need people doing the computations.
I assume there are experiments that use all three aspects, right? For example, there's some things you can do in the lab, but others have to be done through the simulations.
Exactly, exactly. There's certainly things that you could do with computations that we could never envision doing in the lab. Yeah, and then the telescopes, I mean, they're totally unique. So we use those to be able to actually look at these regions of the sky, see which molecules are there. But they rely, again, on lab experiments, because in order to, if you take the data from the telescope, you need to have a lab experiment that tells you what is that light that you're seeing, right? It comes in terms of a spectrum. So if you just have a spectrum, you have no basis for what that spectrum is telling you. You need a lab experiment that also takes the spectrum, and then you can compare the two. So yeah, they really do go hand in hand. And without one of these, you know, parts of the triangle, I think we wouldn't be able to solve any of the problems.
And talking about, you know, spectrums, and I'm seeing one of your papers, spectroscopy is mentioned. So, you know, I think Gurman and I have like a little bit of experience with spectroscopy, like in our undergrad chemistry labs. But how would this process work when you're doing it in space?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's lots of different types of spectroscopy we do or we use for astrochemistry. So I can explain maybe the two most predominant ones that we use. So one of them people will be very familiar with, having now heard a lot in the news about the James Webb Space Telescope. So I think even if people have just a cursory understanding of this telescope, for fascination of it, you know, it's massive and it's beautiful. This is really a spectroscopic technique. So this is an infrared space telescope. And the way that we do this type of spectroscopy is very similar to what you would have learned about in undergraduate. So if you ever went to the lab and you took an FTIR, so a Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, you did an experiment like that, maybe in an organic chemistry lab or something like that. The way that experiment works is you have an infrared light source. Mm-hmm. You have a sample. The sample then absorbs some of the infrared light. And then the rest of the light that isn't absorbed passes through and is detected by a detector. The telescope works in the exact same way, except in a massive scale, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a star, which provides infrared light instead of your FTIR tungsten source or whatever you were using. And then that light passes through a big cloud of gas. And also we might come to this later, but we have lots of dust in these regions of space. They absorb the infrared light. And then some of the light is passed through and detected now with this gigantic space telescope. So that, in a sense, is very similar to the experiments and the spectroscopy that you might have done previously. The other type of spectroscopy we use a lot is rotational spectroscopy, which is not as well known in undergraduate chemistry, as far as I know. So these types of experiments use the rotation of molecules. So instead of stretching a molecule of molecular bonds, we now look at molecules rotating around, and these rotations cause emission of light as well. Yeah. And so these involve a different type of telescope. They involve a radio telescope, and these typically are on Earth. So we don't have space-based radio telescopes. We have them usually in places on Earth where it's quite dry, but we use those to observe these now rotational signals, which are in radio or microwave wavelengths typically. And we would observe those with these radio telescopes. So yeah, those are the two major types for looking for molecules, at least. Yeah.
What kind of range do you get on these telescopes?
What kind of range?
Range, yeah.
Yeah, do you mean in terms of wavelength?
More like distance out into space.
Oh, yeah. So that's a good question. Yeah, so we typically look within our own galaxy. So most of the telescopes that we use would be limited to galactic sources. So we're not looking at these like extreme extragalactic sources that some people in physics might be more interested in. But yeah, you're just limited in terms of sensitivity. So as you start looking further and further away, you're going to have less and less sensitivity. So for us, we tend to look at, you know, things that are the most nearby. We would look for what we call star forming regions, so these big nebula that have the ingredients to form stars, and we look for ones that are relatively nearby because we know that we will get the greatest sensitivity if we look in these regions that are a little bit closer. But yeah, you can peer out a little further, but you just lose in terms of what you can see.
Right.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
Hello, I'm Addy Wolf, and this is my new single, Mastery. You can go check the music video on my website, adewolf.com. That's ADEWOLF.com. Bless.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia. My name is Alirod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Elsa Cook. Dr. Cook is an assistant professor in UBC's Department of Chemistry. So far in the past bit, we've talked about her area of research, which is interstellar chemistry, and we've also touched upon some of the research methods which are used in this field. So going along, Gurman, I think you had a question to ask.
And transitioning to like the laboratory side of things, when I imagine data being collected in the laboratory, I imagine just this like very big vacuum box made cold somehow. What is it really like?
That is exactly it. How did you know? Did you come to the lab? It is in essence. We have a lot of vacuum chambers. So if you were to come into our lab, you would see a lot of kind of metallic big chambers that have bolts all over them. We also use lasers. So we use lasers to both do spectroscopy, but also as light sources. And yeah, I mean, if you've ever been in any kind of, I guess, physics laboratory or maybe a physical chemistry laboratory, it's very similar. So we have lots of, you know, optics and mirrors everywhere, in vacuum chambers. So definitely different to a standard chemical laboratory. We don't use a lot of glassware or fume hoods. It looks a lot different. Mm-hmm. Maybe a comparison that I could make would be Triumph. If anyone's been to Triumph, it looks kind of similar to some of the equipment they have there.
And what kind of compounds are you usually looking at?
Yeah. So we look at lots of different things, but typically we look at small molecules. So we're, again, motivated by the molecules that we know currently exist in space. And so we start off with very small molecules. So in terms of, I guess we haven't talked about this either, but we look at ice. So that's one of my major research areas, is looking at interstellar ices. And they're very small molecules. So things like water, which is what most people associate with ice, but also other small molecules, things like carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and small alcohols. So those are common molecules that we're interested in. But at the moment, one of our main projects is looking at aromatic molecules. So again, starting with the smallest aromatic molecules, things like benzene, and then to slightly larger aromatic molecules. And all of these projects are motivated by the molecules that we see in space. So as we observe them with the telescopes, we then want to go to the lab and try and understand how those molecules form. So yeah, the majority of things we do are small species.
Now, you know, I think this is more so like Gurman probably knows a lot more about this, because I'm not really, I don't have much of a chemistry background, but you know, I know that aromatic molecules such as benzene, they are relatively stable molecules. Is that correct? How would they behave differently in space? Are we seeing that stability still? Are they more stable compared to Earth?
Yeah, okay. So the stability is going to be the same anywhere. There's nothing. So that's a thermodynamic fundamental property of the molecule. It doesn't change regardless of pressure or temperature. So these molecules are still stable in space. The main thing that causes them to be destroyed or kind of lose their concentrations compared to Earth is the fact that we have a lot of radiation around in space, right? So we have a lot of very high energy UV photons, and those molecules can absorb those photons and be broken apart. And that's a major difference on why we don't see so many of these aromatic molecules compared to on Earth. But they still are very stable. So as you mentioned, and for those of the audience who maybe don't know, you know, aromatic molecules are these kind of ultra stable rings of carbon, and are stabilized by this delocalization of electrons within the molecule. So the same goes. I mean, physics is physics everywhere, at least for most of us. Maybe some of the colleagues in physics won't agree, but these molecules are also stable in space. It's just they may last for a shorter amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of time, you mentioned these reactions can last millions of years, like take mm-hmm. place. How do you speed it up in the lab if you can't mess with like temperature or pressure?
Yeah. So that's a good question as well. So we don't tend to mess with temperature in general. So we want to try and simulate the reaction kinetics at a given temperature that would be present in space. So temperature is really, you know, it's the defining factor for reaction kinetics. A reaction has a specific rate constant that depends on temperature. So we want to make sure the temperature is the same as what we would observe in space. But the way that we can speed these things up is by changing the pressure, changing the concentration of molecules. So in space, we have very few molecules, and that's the major difference in terms of reaction time. In these big clouds of gas, we might have as low as one molecule per centimeter cubed. So this is a tiny, tiny number of molecules. On Earth, in the atmosphere, we have something like 10 to the 19 molecules per centimeter cubed. So we have lots and lots of molecules colliding and reacting, whereas in space, so it's every hour, maybe every day, and for some species every month or year, they might collide, and that's what makes these reactions really, really slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when it comes to maybe doing more like laboratory experiments in space, is that something that your lab ever tries to look at? Like, I know NASA does experiments in space. Yeah. Is that something where you can physically possible?
That would be super, super cool. I wish that would be possible. I guess, again, it comes down to our current technologies. So right now, we probably don't have a detection method that could measure such low concentrations of molecules. Maybe sometime in the future, there'll be some crazy smart people that come up with these ideas, that come up with new technology that enable us to measure really low concentrations. But I think that would limit us from doing these experiments in space. And then again, I always like to say it's time. You know, graduate students might have 5 years for their PhD. They don't have a million years, so they're not going to wait a million years for a reaction to happen. It would be wonderful to observe these things in their kind of natural conditions, but the things that we change in the lab are things that we don't anticipate to make major changes in the molecules that are forming in space. So, for example, if we do something at higher pressure than what might happen in space, we make sure that we study the pressure dependence of that reaction. So we would know that pressure wouldn't affect how that reaction would happen in space. And again, that's something where the computations can come in and help when, for example, we might be limited to a pressure range on Earth that we can study. The computations might be able to do a very wide range of pressures. Mm-hmm. So we don't think that we're wrong about these things, but you have to be very careful to make sure that the things that you have, you're limited by on Earth, don't change what could happen in space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you also seem to study how molecules could evaporate in space. And how does evaporation happen in space? I'm guessing it'd be around the transition where stuff gets warmer when stars begin to form, or can it happen those super
cool? You took an astrochemistry course, I'm sure. So that's right. So we would say sublimate. Okay. So we're going directly from the solid phase to the gas phase. So it's not an evaporation process, but sublimation. Mm-hmm. And so, you're exactly right. So we have these regions of space that are very cold. So typically the regions that we study, they might be around 10 Kelvin, which is very, very cold. At those temperatures, you would never have many heavy molecules sublimating. So they wouldn't go from solid phase into the gas phase at these very low pressures. So when we start to form stars, then these molecules and this gas, it starts to warm up and we get temperatures that are more in the range of 50 to 100 Kelvin. And at those temperatures, we are able to start sublimating molecules, at least the small ones. So things like, again, water, CO, CO2, so carbon dioxide, things like that, they can start to sublimate at temperatures around 50 to 100 Kelvin. And then they come into the gas phase. And for us as astrochemists, it's good when they come into the gas phase because it makes them much more easy to detect. So we find it, typically more easy to detect molecules if they're in the gas than in the solid.
What is the significance of it turning into a gas? What can it do aside from just like moving faster, I'm guessing?
Yeah. So there are a few significant points that we can make. So the one I just mentioned, so we're able to detect molecules. Mm-hmm. So for example, say we made a crazy aromatic molecule, a big, large molecule like anthracene or something like that. Say we made that and it was in the ice, we probably wouldn't ever detect that molecule. We wouldn't know that it's there because we don't currently have a good technique for detecting a solid phase molecule that big that would be in ice. But if we were able to, this is actually a really bad example because you can't detect this in the gas phase, but we'll just roll with it. So if it comes off and it sublimates into the gas phase, then we would have a much better chance of detecting that molecule because we could use a radio telescope, and those have techniques that are capable of measuring molecules in the gas phase at pretty low concentrations. So that's one significant factor. The second significant factor is that we're just going to have totally different reactions that could happen. So reactions that could happen in ice or on surfaces are very different to reactions that could happen in the gas phase. And then you also have things like photons. So that's another issue. They can break apart molecules in the gas phase, whereas potentially if that molecule was buried in ice, it might not necessarily be destroyed. So there's a lot of things to consider, but the chemistry is very different in these two phases.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host John P for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia. You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia. My name is Alirad, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Elsa Cook, an assistant professor in UBC's Department of Chemistry. In the past bit, we've been talking a bit about her work in the area of interstellar chemistry, and we touched upon a bit about the chemical composition of compounds which are found in space. So moving along, Gurman, you had something to share.
Yeah, going more into the application side of things. So when I looked at your research, I was looking at things like, oh, carbon, water, lots of life-based things.
Yeah.
I don't want to just like go on the radio and just say aliens, but like...
We're going to do it. We're committing to it.
Like, is this sort of like applied to like how life could form in like a new galaxy of some sort?
Yeah, totally. Again, yeah, we don't want to go on the radio and say aliens, but so what we like to say in chemistry, in astrochemistry, is we never say prebiotic chemistry. We say pre-prebiotic chemistry, right? So you cover all your bases. So what we like to say is we form these molecules that we think could form biological molecules. So the idea is that potentially in these ices or in these big nebula, these astrochemical clouds, we could form molecules like glycine, so very simple amino acids, which we know then form things like DNA, form proteins, all of these molecules that we know make up life. So that's kind of the link there. And, you know, even if we form molecules like glycine, it doesn't necessarily mean aliens, right? So we may form glycine, but it may just happen to be a molecule that is a molecule, right? And it doesn't form life. There's a lot of steps in between forming these very simple amino acids and then forming DNA. So even that, you know, stage is still very uncertain. But the idea is that if we have these ingredients, so we have a lot of carbon, we have a lot of hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, things that make up these molecules of life, and we see them, you know, in these distant regions that form new planetary systems, maybe those planetary systems have the same molecular ingredients that could form life. So we need people that are also working in astrobiology to then collaborate with and, you know, make these leaps between having the molecular ingredients to having life. But it's a start, and it's a start to see that other planets could have molecules that could form life. Yeah, so not aliens, but pre-aliens, yeah.
Yeah, would it be crazy to say that maybe in our own galaxy there may be like biotic life, like on Mars or something, like micro bacteria or whatever?
Yeah, I would have to say that's outside of my realm of knowledge. I don't think it's necessarily crazy to say there could have been life on Mars. I think there is some evidence for, again, coming at it from an astrochemist perspective, evidence for things like liquid water, which we know is potentially essential for forming life. But outside of that, I would have to say that's outside of my realm of knowledge. I think, yeah, in terms of the astrochemistry, we still haven't really detected a lot of these molecules. So things like amino acids and molecules that would make up DNA, we haven't detected those in other planets, even in our solar system. So there's still a lot to be learned before we could say that, from an astrochemist perspective, that life could exist on those planets.
And I would say, amino acids, they're fairly, like, complex molecules. Would you say that the molecules that you study in space so far, they're relatively, like, simple in composition compared to what we generally see in space?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, glycine is pretty simple, but as you go up to these more complex amino acids, nothing like that has been observed so far in space. So even glycine, no amino acid has been observed so far in space. But we have observed more complex molecules than that. So we observe now PAHs, so polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. This has been a very active area of research over the last few years. And those have more atoms and, you know, heavy atoms as well than glycine, for example. So we can form complex molecules. It's not outside of the realm of reactions that can happen in space. It's just a question of why we don't see these biologically complex molecules like amino acids.
And most of the compounds you study, they are organic compounds, I understand. There are are there inorganic compounds being formed in space or no?
No. I don't have it with me, but I have this astrochemist periodic table, which shows this very nicely. So basically, we have a huge amount of molecules that have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And then after that, we have very few molecules detected that have heavier things. So even molecules with, you know, phosphorus and sulfur, so things that we still kind of consider organic molecules, we see some, but not many. And then after that, we don't see any of these heavier elements being incorporated. And again, this is probably a function of their concentration, like you were mentioning earlier on. So their concentration in these clouds. But yeah, it does appear that the majority of this chemistry is organic in nature. So it's very much associated to biological systems, for sure.
Yes, and that's definitely interesting. Yeah, a lot of organic chemistry. You know, you wouldn't think about that being up there in space.
Yeah, definitely. See, the organic chemistry you learn is still useful for other other areas.
No, I'm interested.
Thinking more about like the applications of like astrochemistry, aside from just being really cool, like what can be applied to it?
Yeah, you know, everyone asks this question, especially funding agencies, it turns out. So astrochemistry, I would say, is very far on that side of things, where we're really learning things because we want to know. It's a knowledge-based field, so it's really knowledge for knowledge's sake, right? It's not an applied science at all, but yet things that we learn can be applied to other areas. So I would say my goal is never really applied science. I'm very motivated by this fundamental, what's out there, why do we have these molecules, how do they form? It's very fundamental, but things that we do could be applied to other areas. So we work a lot with kind of vacuum technology, surface science, and lasers, things that are used in the semiconductor industry. So, you know, one of the major products of astrochemistry, I guess, is students and trainees. We produce students that now have technical skills in working with these vacuum systems, working with technology that can be used in lots of different areas. So I would say it's still, it can be applied. We do a lot of programming, computational programming as well. So yeah, areas can be applied to other fields, to things that are more maybe down to earth. But yeah, it's definitely a knowledge-based science.
Yeah, I mean, knowledge for knowledge's sake is never not useful. Like, it's sort of just like that old school science where it's just like learning things for the hell of it and the applications come later.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough in this day and age. I mean, there's only so much money to go around for science, right? And these kind of scientific endeavors are the first ones to get cut. But at the same time, I mean, we're not human if we don't ask questions about our place in the universe, I think. And astrochemistry may seem really insular, and it may seem like something that you would be spending a lot of money to just learn about your molecules floating around in space, but it does connect to these really big questions about yeah, are we alone in the universe? And are there other planets like our own planet? So I think it's worthwhile doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit biased, but yeah, there's questions that we should answer, or at least try to answer as humans.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's probably a first or second year student listening right now while doing their OChem homework. Is there anything you would want to say to them that if they're interested in astrochemistry, what should they do next?
Yeah, sure. The interesting thing about doing astrochemistry research is you can really come from almost any area in science, I would say. So like I mentioned, I came from doing a chemistry degree. I never took astronomy in undergraduate. I took one astronomy course in graduate school. But I didn't come in, you know, thinking that I would have the capability of doing something like this. I came with a very narrow mindset of thinking, oh, I could do spectroscopy. Spectroscopy is pretty cool. And I liked physical chemistry. And I think that's kind of still the way that chemistry is being taught, is you kind of end up in, I like organic chemistry, I should do synthesis. I like physical chemistry, I should go do spectroscopy. But, you know, you can like organic chemistry and be an astrochemist, right? So we really come from all of these different areas. People that I work with are trained in astronomy. They might be computer scientists, astrobiologists. And, the great thing at undergraduate level is you now have the basis to be able to decide what is your interest. So maybe you're skilled and you really like organic chemistry, but what is it, that area outside of organic chemistry that you're really passionate about? And how do you want to apply your skills? Where can you be useful in graduate school or in the working environment? And how do you want to use those basic skills that you learned? So, yeah, I would say that if someone's doing organic chemistry homework and they think, man, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard, and astrochemistry is for me, definitely explore it and see if it's something that you might like to do research in.
Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely something I would consider if I wasn't already in the middle of a professional school. Yeah, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you about this.
Yeah, thanks pleasure. For joining us. We really appreciate you joining us here and like sharing all your knowledge about this area.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirad Ameri, and along with my co-host German Gill, today we interviewed Dr. Elsa Cook, an assistant professor in UBC's Department of Chemistry. We thank you for tuning in and listening today. And if you'd like to listen to more Research Review, you can join us 2 weeks from now on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Previous episodes of Research Review are also available on the CITR website at citr.ca.